Welcome to the Doubles Only Tennis Podcast, where you learn the best doubles strategies to improve your game and win more matches. I'm your host, Will Bocek. This podcast, my website, and my weekly newsletter all focus on the goal of better understanding the sport of doubles and helping players like you improve faster through actionable advice that you can use in your very next match. My goal is to provide the best doubles strategy resources in the world. And to do that, I study, analyze, and work with players at every level of the game, all the way up to the ATP and WTA tours. If you enjoy this podcast, I've created double strategy products that go even deeper if you want to take your doubles knowledge to the next level. At the end of this episode, I'll explain more about them, or if you want to learn more now, go to thetennistribe.com/products. Here's today's episode. In this episode, I chat with Rajiv Ram, who is coming off his third consecutive U.S. Open men's doubles title alongside his partner, Joe Salisbury. And I ask him a lot about the U.S. Open and kind of the season as a whole. It's been a bit of a roller coaster, a little bit of a different year for the duo, where they've dealt with some injuries and some disappointing results early in the season. And he talks a lot about how they were able to turn it around in New York and what worked so well for them during those couple of weeks. I also asked him about his new coach, Chris Eaton, who he's actually been working with for a while. We talk Davis Cup, Olympics next year, teaming up with Austin Krajicek, plans for 2024. And then we talk a little bit about some kind of club-level doubles tips and advice. So I asked him, what advice does he have for players or teams who aren't doing so well in a match? So we've all been there. We're down a set. Maybe we're down a break, and we feel like we just don't have our A game today. Rajiv shares what he does in those situations that I feel like you can use in your own matches. I also asked him how he decides when to hit a lob return versus cross court versus down the line. And then he has a few tips for playing better in 10-point tiebreakers as well, which we get a lot at the club level, and he gets a lot at the pro level. And then at the end, I ask him some of your questions from Instagram, including what changes he made to his game when he was transitioning from singles to doubles. I really found his answer surprising, and I really liked his answer a lot to this one. He shares tips for female partners in mixed doubles. I asked him about serving into the wind versus with the wind, serving into the sun versus with the sun behind you, how he and Joe decide that, and then also why he is eating sushi in the middle of the U.S. Open. He was actually eating sushi during a changeover in a U.S. Open match, so he talks a little bit about that as well. And at the end, we talk about kind of the state of doubles and what one change he would make to the tour to make it better for fans and better for doubles in general. So without further delay, enjoy this conversation with three-time U.S. Open doubles champion, Rajiv Ram. Today we have 2021, 2022, and 2023 U.S. Open champion on Rajiv Ram. Rajiv, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So I had Michael Jordan scheduled for today, but when you won a few weeks ago, I told him to step aside and I said, Rajiv just won his third consecutive U.S. Open. So tell us, how does one three-peat?
I would have loved to listen to Michael Jordan. Why'd you have to do that?
I'll have both of y'all on next time.
it was an unbelievable tournament for us. How does one three-peat? I wish I had a formula for that, but something special about that place, you know, definitely for Joe and I over the last few years, even the year before, you know, we made the semis and we lost a tough one. We played well there for a long time now. And to actually get over the line this year, given that we haven't, you know, necessarily had our best year in terms of results, was incredibly special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to talk about this season. There's a few times, so I'll check the ATP doubles race rankings every couple of weeks or so. Mm-hmm. And y'all's season wasn't going, I imagine, according to plan. And I remember there was a few times I tweeted out, about your ranking, and y'all were around like 16 or 19 at one point. And I was like, this might be the first year y'all don't make the ATP finals as a pair. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think y'all made like five consecutive or something.
Yeah. Four. And then, yeah. The first 4 years we played, we did. Yeah. This would have been
four.
Five,
okay. Yeah. Okay. So, so now y'all are all the way up to, I think, six in the race, mm-hmm. with the US Open win. What do you make of the season, since it has been a little bit of a roller coaster and a little bit different for y'all?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it happens, I think. You know, I mean, we've had four, mm-hmm. maybe not four full ones, but three and a half amazing years. You know, 19, we just started playing, and the back half of that was really good. And 20, 21 and 22, we're all incredible. I think we qualified for Turin before the US Open started, even in those years. And obviously 20 was a little bit weird with COVID and all, but you know, mm-hmm. we won the Turin Open that year. So we were basically in it right after the first month. And so, you know, in my opinion, it's impossible to just keep going. You're going to definitely have those waves. And, you know, we were dealing with a couple of injuries. Joe's back hasn't been great, and my Achilles has given me a lot of trouble throughout this year. I basically took all of February off to try and, you know, get it right or get it better. And it didn't really go as well as I'd hoped, or as quickly as I would have hoped. And the surfaces were a tough thing for me to play on clay and to play on the grass with that. So, you know, we had a few things going against us for sure. But, you know, I think we always knew that if we were able to put some good work in and we were able to sort of turn that corner of playing well, you know, that we could get on a roll, and we were still, you know, going to be very difficult to beat. And that's sort of, I felt like, what happened this summer. We were able to put in a lot of hours, a lot of good work. And even though results didn't come straight away or as consistently as we would have liked, we knew that if we kind of got the ball rolling, we were still going to be very, very difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like it was maybe partly at least a product of like consecutive weeks healthy?
That was a big part of it. And not even necessarily tournament weeks or result weeks. It was just more consistent work that we could put in to be at the level that we knew we needed to be at for a big run at the US Open.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. What is something you learned about either yourself or you and Joe as a team this season?
That, you know, even if it comes, even if there's moments or stretches of not very good results and not very good play, that, you know, we were able to find that it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to happen with work, and it's going to happen with dedication, and it's going to happen with all that. But if we do put all that in, even if, you know, for 6 months, the results weren't there, that we are still able to compete, you know, with the best teams in the world and play at a super high level. So, mm-hmm. I think if anything, it just made me feel more like we have that in us. And it doesn't have to always be there for us to find it again, which is a nice feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. So I remember last time we talked, you were locked in your hotel in Australia during quarantine, I think for like 10 or 14 days. And we talked about the NOAD and then 10-point tiebreaker format. And I remember you saying, I think you said you would rather get rid of the NOAD than get rid of the 10-point tiebreaker.
Yeah.
How much of maybe, you know, if you call it like a lack of results or kind of a down early part of the season, how much of it do you attribute to that? Because with that short format outside of the Grand Slams, it seems like you can play a really good match and still lose to a good team multiple weeks in a row, just because there's so much left to chance on some of those NOAD points and the 10-point tiebreakers.
Yeah. For us specifically this year, I don't attribute that much of it to that. I mean, we lost first round at Wimbledon when it was, you know, full scoring. We lost, you know, third round, which isn't terrible, but third round at the French and at the Australian Open. So I don't really think it has anything to do with that. Like I said, it's more about the fact that we weren't able to, you know, put in regular, continuous, you know, good day after day after day to sort of get us to that point when we were in a tough situation that we honestly believe like we deserve to get out of it. And I think that mm-hmm. was the biggest difference, is that when we were in those tough situations at the US Open, we believed that we deserved to get out of it because of the fact that we put the work in beforehand. Mm-hmm. And earlier in the year, you know, I think we were hoping to get out of it, get out of those tough situations. And there's a huge difference between hoping and believing like you deserve it. And that only happens if you're able to put in that work. And we weren't able to do that for a large part of this year.
Interesting. Okay. That's a good distinction. So believing you should get out of it because you've been healthy for long enough to put in the hours and put in the match play and the practice versus just being a little more hopeful. I like that a lot. So you have a new coach, Chris Eaton. Talk about that a little bit. How did that relationship start? How did that decision kind of come about?
Yeah, actually it's funny. It's not really new. Chris and I started working together, you know, remotely since in 2017. The year that I decided to stop playing singles, I called him up because the year before that he worked with Continent and Pierce. And so he had, you know, been coaching against me, let's say, a little bit here and there. And then he took the job at Wake Forest as the assistant. So he was, you know, full time doing that. But I called him up and I said, hey, listen, you know, I'm doing this doubles thing now. He's a guy that I'd known for a long time. I'd played against him as a player. And then obviously, like I said, as a coach. And so I said, you know, do you think we could work together? You could help me kind of, you know, really understand how this works. And so we actually did 2 weeks of off-season training while he was recruiting at the Eddie Herr and the Orange Bowl down in Florida. I went down and we would do sessions in the evening kind of when those matches were over. And so we had two good weeks there and have sort of developed this system of, you know, chatting and talking and going through things, you know, over the phone remotely and then meeting up whenever we could. He would be at the Slams recruiting for the college. And so we would come out and help whenever he was around. It wasn't as much as it would be ideal, obviously, but it's not certainly something that was brand new. And then just this year he decided that he wanted to fully step away from that. And we had worked it out where he could join us on the road full time more or less full time. And so we started traveling together fully at the French, but it's by no means a new thing.
Got it. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. What's something that he brings to the table being on the road full time for you? What are kind of his best assets as a coach?
I mean, you know, I think it's familiarity for me. I mean, that's the thing that makes me be able to compete, you know, day in and day out at the highest level, sort of get to that space where I am fully locked in and I'm fully, you know, fully dialed in to be able to really bring the best out of me as a competitor. I think familiarity and comfort is a huge part of that for me personally as a player. So, like I said, he's someone who's been there from the very beginning of me starting to play doubles exclusively. And he's seen the ups and the downs. I've gone through a couple partners and I've gone through a couple of different situations like that. So it's someone that I know I can fully trust and I can fully rely on and who really knows me as a player and as a person incredibly well. So I think that is it. You know, that's the biggest part of it is just that sort of comfort level.
Okay. So you just finished Davis Cup. Last year, obviously, there was a little bit of drama around that, not making the team. Talk about Davis Cup. How was that? You and Austin went 2-1. I think the only loss was a 10-point tiebreaker because the match was decided.
Yeah.
How was the Davis Cup experience?
Oh, man. It was, look, anytime I get the opportunity to play for my country and for the U.S., I'm going to take it. I'm going to play as hard as I can. It's as important to me as anything else is winning the U.S. Open. You know, if we are able to or are ever able to win the Davis Cup, it'll be right up there with any slam that I've won or anything like that. So, our two matches were great. I thought we did, you know, we did everything we could and we competed great, especially on the back of a tough trip. We both did well at the US Open. You know, as you said, he made the semis. I made obviously, you know, ended up winning it. And so it was not easy to get over there. You know, the teams we played against were really tough. I think our singles guys played their hearts out, just unfortunately came up on the wrong side of a few matches and couldn't get through as a team, which was disappointing for everyone for sure. You know, I was encouraged greatly by the way that Austin and I played for hopefully future situations in Davis Cup and the Olympics and whatnot. But it was overall, you know, you go there to win as a team. And so you win, lose as a team, no matter what. And so it was, pretty disappointing that we didn't get through that.
Yeah. So are you planning to play with Austin at the Olympics? I know that's probably not like totally decided, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I mean, I think that's the plan right now. I mean, we're sitting here at September of the year before. So a lot of things can happen between now and Is it August? Yeah, August of next year. It's almost so, a yeah. year, a full year away, which is yeah. a long time in tennis players' lives for sure. But yeah, as of now, I mean, that's the idea. You know, we've known each other for a long time, and I think we both love to play with each other. So that would be, yeah, that'd be the idea.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm sure y'all will be one of the favorites heading into it for sure, assuming everybody's healthy.
Yeah.
What about 2024? Any plans outside of the Olympics for 2024?
Nothing yet. I mean, you know, we still have a fair bit of this season left for sure. I think, you know, right. we're really, one thing is that we get to go play in Asia, which we haven't done over the last 3 years. So, you know, that's a difference for sure. And then we still have, you know, basically at 2000s left in Shanghai and Paris, and Joe and I haven't won one of those yet this year. So that, I think that's a big goal of ours to try and get one of those. And then we're defending the title in Turin. So, you know, there's a lot of really important tennis to be played. I know it's kind of weird because everyone feels like the season sort of yeah. slows down or ends after the US Open, and then it's just not the case. So, you know, right. 24 is still a ways away. So we're still, you know, going to do our best to really try and finish 23 strong, you know, probably especially more so because we didn't start 23 as well as we would have liked. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. So a couple of, so a lot of the listeners are kind of club level doubles players. Mm-hmm. I want to ask a couple of questions for them. So what advice would you have for players or teams that are maybe in a little bit of a dip and they're not doing so well? And this could be during maybe a league season or even during a particular match. Maybe you lose the first set, you're not playing as well. How do you kind of handle that yourself? And what advice would you have in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, for me, we'll start with the match in specific. For me, I think usually when I don't feel like I'm playing my best, it's for some reason I'm not in the right state of mind. You know, I'm not in that competitive state of mind. So I, you know, figuring out, just thinking, having that clarity to think about, okay, what is it that's going on? Am I nervous? Am I flat? Am I tired from the day before or some other reason? Am I, you know, distracted? Like, what is it that's actually not allowing me to sort of be in that right mindset? And then dealing with that, I feel like once you can identify the issue and just sort of put it out there to yourself, even, or maybe even to your partner, you know, that's a big thing for Joe and I, is that we're able to, you know, say, hey, listen, I'm feeling, you know, this way for this reason. And just even saying it and putting it out there sometimes takes a lot of the anxiety away from it. Right. And so, you know, I'll give you a great example. This year at the US Open, it was that happened, right? I mean, we were getting smoked in the finals of the first, you know, in the finals of the first set, we got smoked. And I was like, man, Joe, I'm just a little flat. Like, we had a quick turnaround the day before. Like, I know it's the finals of the US Open, and I'm trying to get myself up for it, but it's just not happening. And then we just sort of said, okay, once I said that, it was like, okay, we can try and deal with it one point at a time, you know, take little small gains, small wins, and hopefully build myself and our team back up to that level of competitiveness. And it happened to work this time. We drew on past experiences because 2 years ago we were in the exact same position, and, you know, we were able to come out on the good end of it. So a lot of times just identifying what that is a big part of dealing with it in, you know, mid-match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, I like that, because you're using your partner to kind of help lift you up, which I feel like a lot of club level players maybe don't do. Maybe they kind of internalize it and keep it to themselves.
That's a big deal.
You are a team, so you have to be communicating that information to each other.
100%. 100%.
So another thing, I watched a couple of y'all's matches, and one thing I feel like you do really well, I don't know if you do this, I was talking to Dave about this, and I feel like y'all lob return a little bit more often than some other teams. How do you decide when to lob versus hit cross court versus hit down the line? Is there something you're looking for from the other team, or is it matchup dependent where you've kind of scouted and decided before the match, or some combination? Talk about your return decisions.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's definitely matchup dependent. If you know a team, you've played them before, you know they serve really well, and you know their service partner position is very aggressive, close to the net, or they're very good at it. You know, if you feel like, even if I hit a good one, they're going to be able to knock it off and put you on defense. I mean, so then you know the only way to kind of get the point started is to lob a bit. Some of it's in the mid match. If you feel like, oh, I'm the original plan was trying to hit and, you know, hit either down line, cross court, or kind of start the point that way, but it's just not working. Either you're having a bad day returning, or they're serving really well, or some kind of condition isn't really there. I think that, I mean, the lob is such a vital and valuable play, and especially in men's doubles off the return, because the guys just serve so big and so well that quite often you kind of get taken out of the game a little bit, you know, and sometimes you can just, if nothing else, even if you lose the point, you push the service partner back off the net a little bit, so it gives you a little bit more space to hit. But yeah, sometimes it's predetermined, sometimes it's mid-match, but we go to it quite often. Like, we try not to get too far in the hole of just, you know, easy hold after easy hold before at least trying that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's something you said there was, even if you lose the point, it might push the server's partner off the net. So that's something I feel like a lot of people miss, right? Like, oh, I hit the lob return. Well, it didn't work. I guess that was useless.
Yeah.
But in reality, that might, like you said, pull the server's partner off the net, and then open up the cross court return, or maybe allow you to get it to their feet a little bit more. So I think that's a really important point that I want to highlight there for the listeners.
Yeah. So quite often it's a setup for the rest of the set, game, match, whatever, as opposed to that one specific point.
Right. We talked a little bit, or I mentioned 10-point tiebreakers earlier. Do you have any routines or advice for players who maybe struggle to win 10-point tiebreakers? Is there anything that you can do to kind of try to play your best during those moments?
Yeah, I mean, we as a team, we just try to be as physical as possible in those moments, right? I mean, I feel like the 10-point tiebreakers, especially, obviously a lot's on the line, and maybe the natural reaction is to potentially go in your shell a little bit, or just not be as free, and you know, you think about the result, you know a lot of things, right? There's a lot of things right in there, and for us, if we're just sort of focused on being as physical as possible, you know, it's running your hardest, jumping your hardest, you know, split stepping, really the basics of physicality in tennis, that seems to help us in those moments just be a little bit sharper and a little bit better. Because I think it's, you know, it's too difficult at that point to think about too much strategy or too much technical stuff. You got to really dumb it down for yourself, because there's a lot going on, you know? And so I feel like that's the thing that we've kind of had as the basics. And that means different things to different people. Some people have to jump around, move their feet a little. Some people have to maybe get a little bit more locked in with their eyes. You know, I don't really know. I think that's different from person to person, but we just try to really focus on that part of it in those breakers, especially.
So when you say physicality, you mentioned kind of focusing on moving your feet more and running as hard as you can. I think some listeners might hear, okay, I'm going to try to hit the ball harder. Is that what you're talking about as well, or not necessarily?
No, not at all. Actually, hitting the ball is sort of the result of all of that stuff, you know?
Okay. I think that's
when
important.
We talk about physicality, we kind of talk about everything but hitting the ball, because the hitting the ball part should sort of, in my opinion, be a result of the rest of the stuff. Your focus, your concentration, your how much you move your feet, how physical you are with all that stuff. And then it's kind of like the hitting the ball part should just happen, you know, because if you focus too much on that, I feel like that's where you kind of get in trouble with the rest of it. You know, you're focusing on the result more as opposed to the process there. And so that's sort of we try to do things to lessen that, you know, because you have what you have on the day. Some days you're going to hit the ball great. Some days you're not going to hit the ball great, but maybe you can just make it a little bit better by being better in those other areas.
Right. Yeah. I feel like focusing on the footwork is super important, because when players get tied, especially at our level, they struggle with their upper body and their swing. They'll kind of maybe not follow through, or like not swing freely, right? And miss. So if you can focus on your feet, then you're not as worried about your upper body, and it'll just kind of take care of itself a little bit more.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Freely. So several questions here from some fans on Instagram. Number one, what changes did you make to your game while transitioning from singles to doubles?
You know, it wasn't really that many changes in my tennis. It was more some of this other stuff that we're talking about, right? Like in singles, if you have a bad day competing or a bad day mentally, you can't share it with anyone. You just have to figure it out yourself. And like I said, some of the stuff that, and we as tennis players, I mean, I played singles for, you know, 30 years or whatever it was, you know, maybe, whatever, really long. And so you get into these habits of, if something is there, you just deal with it yourself and you almost don't look to try and, you know, lean on a partner. And then all of a sudden when you are playing doubles, you have that option and that ability, and a lot of, oftentimes it helps. So it's just like being able to say, hey, listen, you know, this is what I'm feeling today. And I'm, you know, I'm feeling great. I'm feeling bad. I'm nervous. I'm happy. I'm sad, whatever it might be, that might help the team. And also listening to your partner when they have something to say and try to, you know, deal with it together. So just sort of being aware of that and being open to doing it was probably the biggest change for me. It was much less about the tennis and more about the competitiveness.
Hmm. Did that take some time? Is there anything you did to kind of learn that, I guess? Any sort of training you did to learn to be more open with your communication?
I mean, just like anything else, it's just practice, you know? So that doesn't just happen in matches, right? When we're having a practice day and I'm sitting to say, hey, Joe, listen, today, you know, this is bothering me a little bit. I'm going to serve a little bit less, or I'm feeling great today. I'm going to really treat this like it's a match, even though it's practice. You do whatever you want to do, but this is how I'm going to treat it today. So it's like, you know, doing those things in practice on a daily basis, then all of a sudden when a match comes along, it's much easier to do it, as opposed to the first time you're going to try and do it is in a match is quite often hard. You know, you don't even know what you're thinking yourself sometimes, let alone trying to express it.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So next question, tips for female partners in mixed.
What do you mean? Like what should...
That's all the context I have. So yeah, I guess doubles, tips, double strategy tips or tactical tips for, the female partner in mixed.
I mean, I think the one thing is that, you know, obviously if there's a choice, oftentimes, like if you're both at the net, like you're probably going to get more of the balls coming at you, you know? So just being ready as best as you can that, you know, the ball is probably going to come at you if there's a choice, and that's okay. Like that's totally fine. It's not like anyone, it makes it worse or better, or you're supposed to, you have more pressure, just being ready that the balls are going to come at you. And then also being aware that, you know, when there's a choice for you to hit it, it's probably good to pick on the girl a little bit, especially if there's a situation to make him hit an overhead or make him hit, you know, something to where the guys might be a little bit stronger. So I just think, you know, a little bit of awareness that, you know, you're going to be picked on and there's somebody on the other side that you can pick on is probably the best. Cause the best mixed partners I've had are, they do just that. They know that, you know, they know that they're going to get more balls, but that's okay. And they know where to hit them when they have a chance.
Yeah. Yeah. I was watching, I think it was the mixed final a couple of weeks ago and Renee Stubbs was calling it. And yeah. she was so funny. Cause she was just, I forgot who it was. It might've been Austin or,
Austin and Jess were in the finals.
Harry won it. It might have been a semifinal match. I don't know, but there was somebody who like wasn't picking on the girl enough, at least according to Renee. And she was like, "Why is he lobbing the guy? Like that is the dumbest thing you can do." And it was just so funny listening to her.
Yeah.
But yeah, typically lobbing the girl, I think, is a good tactic because usually they're a little shorter. That it have a less of a wingspan, not as big of an overhead.
Exactly.
But yeah, listening to Renee the other day was hysterical. That reminded me of that.
That's funny.
Couple of quick ones. Do you prefer to serve into the wind or with the wind?
You know, I usually serve on the tougher side, whether it's the sun or the wind or whatever, when Joe and I play. If I had my choice, I'd like to serve with the wind. Helps, but yeah, I'm okay. I'll deal with that. I'm lucky in the sense that I can usually serve okay on whichever side.
Yeah. Well, why do you choose the tougher side? Just because your serve is because a little bit bigger?
We feel like my serve is, his serve is easier to hold if it's, you know, we've got a little wind behind it or if there's not a sun issue or whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Any funny moments with Joe that you can share? It's kind of open ended.
Yeah, that's very open-ended. Off the top of my head, I'll have to get back to you. I'll think of one, but I can't think of something off the top of my head. Okay. We do a pretty good job of keeping it pretty, you know, business like on the court. We have a good
professional
time. Yeah. Any funny moments? I can't think of one. I mean, he tends to be a little late sometimes and miss some flights and do some goofy things like that.
But it's really?
Yeah.
What's a flight that he's missed?
Can't remember what specific one, but sometimes he shows up at the airport and he's booked the wrong date or something. You know, he's not the best with his admin. So
that's so funny. Okay. Tell us what happened when you ordered sushi during the finals.
Yeah, that's kind of taken off, huh? That's really really come alive, that sushi deal. I actually did it in the semis too. It was nothing more than I just felt like I was a little bit like it was a really tough semifinal match, and I just felt like I needed a little fuel. That was it. And I eat sushi quite often, like right before I play, because it's easy to digest and it goes down all right. And so I know they have those packets in the restaurant. So I asked for one during the semi, and then we had a super quick turnaround. I think we finished about 4:30 in the afternoon on Thursday, and we had to turn around and play at noon on Friday in the final. And so sort of the same kind of thing was happening. I didn't want it to get that far. I felt like I could sort of feel like I was needing a little fuel, and so I asked for another one.
That's so funny.
I almost took one out for the final, and I thought, nah, I should be all right because I ate a better meal and all that. But yeah, I needed it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy. Sushi during a tennis match just sounds like a terrible idea to me.
I know. But it does to a lot of people, but it works fine for me. So
yeah. Whatever works for you.
Exactly.
Okay. So last couple questions here. Last time we chatted, I asked you how we can make doubles more popular. You talked about more time on the big courts. I've got some notes here on it. Stronger marketing efforts. You said people are drawn to stories, and if you can make it a little bit more personal rather than just an opening act for singles, then that can help. How are you feeling about kind of the state of doubles, and what do you think still needs to change?
I mean, I didn't remember those exact answers that I said, but I would agree with all of them. I still think that's the biggest thing. For example, I mean, it's not just because it's me, but we just won 3 US Opens in a row, and that's not happened in the open era. And I feel like if something were to have happened in singles that's not happened in the open era, you and every other tennis fan would know about it, And I feel like what a great opportunity to tell a story, to make doubles a little bit more personable and all that to a fan, is that, look, there's a team out there that's just done this. Last year, a good friend of mine, Jules Roger, won a slam at 42 years old. I want to say, I think he was the oldest slam winner. And it's like, how cool would that be to, maybe relatable to someone that's playing at the club level, that's about that age, that's, doing their thing on the club. And you're like, man, a person your age has just won the French Open. Like, it's an incredible effort. And so we have these stories that are happening. They genuinely are happening. But I feel like where we're missing is capitalizing on the fact that they are, and making that sort of pretty well known to the tennis community that they should watch doubles for these reasons. Cause I think it's some pretty cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Just better marketing of those stories for sure. What change would you make if you were given, all the power to make one change in tennis to help doubles? What change would you make?
I would make it in all of tennis, and I would make it so that people are able to come in and out of courts more easily. I think the most ridiculous thing that we have in tennis is that someone turns up to a match and it's 15 love of the first game, and they got to wait 3 full games to get in. Like I would be over it at that point. That could be 30 minutes. The way that some of these singles matches are going right now, you could be waiting in line for 30 minutes. Can you imagine buying a ticket for a basketball game and you said, hang on a minute, you can't actually watch what you've come to watch because of some reason like that, you got to wait a half an hour. That wouldn't go over very well. So I feel like in tennis in general, we sometimes don't think of it from the fans' perspective as much as we should. And I think, I don't think we can do much, because I think it's quite a great spectacle that we can put on. But I feel like that's one of the biggest issues. I would let people have a little bit more freedom. Maybe not at the back of the court, maybe something, but some capacity of movement would be great.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking about this with a coach in New York actually. And we agreed on that. And we said, the back of the court. So if you take like, take the back of the court and then go, we'd have a certain level where we'd cut it off. So it might be like 20 feet above the height of the court or 30 yeah. feet above the height of the court. And yeah. like those particular seats, like you do have to wait for a game change or a changeover or something, but everyone else should be allowed to move around the stadium.
Right. I think that's a great idea. Let's try that. You know, let's try something to make it more fan friendly. Yeah.
Yeah. I totally agree. Cause it is no fun at all to sit outside, outside there. No other sport has that. So awesome. Any final requests to the audience? Any final comments, Rajiv, before we let you go?
No, I mean, I appreciate what you do. Your slogan of watch more doubles. I think it's amazing. You know, I think men and, you know, women's doubles, mixed doubles. I mean, we're the only sport. I shouldn't say the only, I got to say we're probably one of the few sports that, you know, we compete for major titles and Olympic medals and in mixed, you know, men and women playing against men and women. It's pretty cool. I think it's a great dynamic. So yeah, I think doubles of all kind is great. I think people play it more than they play singles at the recreational level. So yeah, we'd love to have anyone and everyone that come to watch us play.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Rajiv. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you all next week. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Doubles Only podcast. If you're interested in diving deeper into any topics I discuss, I've created double strategy products that allow me to bring you more podcasts and other doubles content without relying on paid ads. I have ebooks and courses that help you make better strategic decisions during matches and become the smartest player on the court. Go to thetennistribe.com/products to learn more. You can also join my free weekly double strategy newsletter that includes video lessons and more on our homepage. If you want to connect, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or email me directly, will@thetennistribe.com.